John Munson in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network. This hour we focus on Ukraine and what's going on there and Russia's imperial aims, seemingly. Yesterday, the United States and its closest allies cast Russia out of the group of eight industrialized democracies, their most exclusive club. That from an article in the New York Times. We'll be talking about the Ukraine today with William Pomerantz, Deputy Director of the Kenan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies of the Woodrow Wilson Center, an adjunct professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. Professor Pomerantz, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Glad to be here.
All right, so President Obama was successful, to no one's surprise, in getting Russia excluded from the G8. What kind of message should that send to Vladimir Putin, and do we have any evidence that he's actually listening?
Well, I think it's going to send a message that that it will not be business as usual going forward as a result of the actions in Crimea. That being said, the G8, or now G7, really is a forum for discussion. It's not really a formal organization, as it were, and there are plenty of international organizations that Russia is a member of. So it won't be a major blow to Vladimir Putin, but it will be a message.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that has been interesting to a lot of people in this, it may be getting down into the weeds a little bit, but there doesn't seem to be any country that has come to Russia's defense over basically its takeover of the Crimea.
No, Russia's actions has been met with a deafening silence, and there's been no outward support from China, which is not surprising because it has its own internal ethnic divisions. And there hasn't been any real outburst of support from the other post-Soviet states, which again is not surprising. Kazakhstan, for example, has a substantial Russian population, Russian-speaking population. And in light of Mr. Putin's announcement in his address last week about Russia's right to come to the defense of any Russian speakers outside its borders, Kazakhstan must be feeling a little concerned. So no one has rallied or to President Putin's support, nor have they recognized Russia's actions with Crimea.
So I guess that brings up the question, how do we define who's Russian and who isn't?
Well, Vladimir Putin has taken a very expansive definition of who is Russian and has really basically said anyone who is a Russian speaker, who is outside the borders of the Russian Federation, could be considered a Russian. And this is a definition that, again, no one will really recognize, but it would allow, theoretically, for Russia to intervene anywhere there are ethnic Russian speakers still in that country.
So pretty much anywhere in the world, then?
Well, I don't see him marching down the streets of L.A. anytime soon. But obviously there are countries very close to Russia. Kazakhstan and Moldova obviously come immediately to mind. And there are also the Baltic states, which have sizable Russian populations, but also happen to be members of NATO. So that would be a different calculus.
You talk about, in an article that that you wrote recently, you talk about President Putin being out of step with the modern world. What world is he living in?
Well, I think he's living in a 19th century imperial world, where imperial powers have the right to intervene militarily, essentially anywhere they want, in defense of how they define their interests. That was how the world was governed, really up until World War II in many ways. But after World War II, with the collapse of the British and French empires, we went through a long process of decolonization, where countries were recognized as sovereign entities. And therefore, Putin doesn't really understand or doesn't really recognize the notion, based on his actions now, of these decolonized sovereign states. And he has basically asserted an imperial doctrine that he can interfere anywhere within the former boundaries of the Russian Empire.
Meanwhile, it appears that the Ukraine is giving up Crimea as it withdraws its troops from the peninsula, Russia moving in. Why isn't the Ukraine fighting for this territory?
Well, I think Ukraine in many ways wanted to fight for Crimea, but it was really placed in a a no-win situation. Russia had a naval base there. It had military troops there. It used those bases to bring in other military troops. And it essentially was not going to be a fair fight. And it was essentially going to be, you know, a suicide mission, as it were, if Ukraine was going to fight militarily in Crimea. And I think what Ukraine made a calculation was it wasn't going to fight in Crimea, but it would fight to defend mainland Ukraine. And that's where the current crisis is today.
I guess I'd like to try to get us to some understanding of what may have precipitated this, if there was any one event or series of events. The Ukraine was moving closer to Europe. There was some... is this about Vladimir Putin trying to prevent the Ukraine from signing some sort of free trade agreement with the European Union?
Yeah, it goes back to that in November of 2013, Ukraine had the option of signing what was an association agreement with the EU that required significant reforms inside of Ukraine, but also hold out the possibility and the reality of creating a free trade zone between the EU and Ukraine. And that was perceived as a major advantage for Ukraine. But from Russia's perspective, it was perceived as a major loss. Russia is busy trying to establish its own kind of trading partnership, the so-called Customs Union and Eurasia Union, and Russia wanted Ukraine to be an essential member of that. So Russia essentially intervened. It said that it implored and argued with President Yanukovych and begged him not to sign the association agreement. And when Yanukovych decided not to sign that agreement, we had the initial round of protests that ultimately culminated with the overthrow of President Yanukovych.
800-642-1234 is the number to call. We're talking about the situation in Ukraine, the growing evidence for the idea that Vladimir Putin has got some imperial aims, and perhaps the Ukraine isn't the only country in his sights. And what do you make of all of this? What do you think our foreign policy should be in this situation? Do you have questions about what's happening over there? And what about booting Russia from this summer's G8 talks? Do you think that's going to do any good? And how do you think we've handled it so far? Some are calling for us to arm the Ukrainians and help them out militarily. Others are very worried about another land war breaking out. There's plenty to talk about here. Get in touch and let's have the discussion. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also email us, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, and you can find the Joy Cardine Show on Facebook and leave a comment or question there. My guest is William Pomerantz, Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies of the Woodrow Wilson Center and Adjunct Professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. We'll have your calls and questions and Facebook comments still to come. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, it's the Ukraine. That's what we're talking about, what's going on over there. If you have questions about what's happening in the Ukraine or some opinion on what U.S. foreign policy should be, by all means, let us know. 800-642-1234. If you get a busy signal, try emailing us, talk@WPR.org, or leave a comment on Facebook. We'll go to the phones in just a moment. But first, Russia, certainly the Soviet Union had colonies. They made colonies out of a number of surrounding areas. The Baltics leap to mind as the most obvious. Is there any feeling in any of these former Soviet colonies that they should return to the Russian fold? How do they feel about what President Putin is doing in Ukraine?
Well, I think there are sizable minority Russian populations in both Estonia and in Latvia, two former Baltic republics of the Soviet Union. But there is really no sense that they would want to return to the Russian Empire. And obviously they are now members of the EU and of NATO, so that they are now entrenched in the Western security system. and any sort of attempt by Russia to incorporate them would produce a response not just from the Baltic states, but also from their allies in NATO.
Let's go to the phones. We'll start with Mike in Milwaukee. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I have a question. Even if we forget about 20th century empire building by the United States, even in the last 10, 15 years, what we've been doing, involving ourselves in our sphere of influence in Venezuela and I forget if it was Ecuador or one of the other South American countries that are socialist, we don't tolerate anything like that anywhere near our borders. We're also involved in Africa. We're also involved. Anybody that we want to do trade with, it has to be friendly to us. And what's going on in Europe is very similar to President Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt's policy, the open door policy. So I see this continuing on into the 21st century. I don't think we have a right to talk here.
Well, I do think we have a right to talk here because there was a post-World War II consensus that the Russian Federation at least has signed on to. And Russia had agreed to recognize the sovereignty of the post-Soviet states. And in doing so, it was in compliance with the UN Charter. It was in compliance with the Helsinki Final Act. And there was also a memorandum, the so-called Budapest Memorandum, where Russia again guaranteed the sovereignty of Ukraine. So I think there are, I'm not here to kind of discuss the broader ramifications of U.S. foreign policy, which also raise questions. But in this particular case, in how Russia has decided to annex Crimea, it has raised real important questions about international law, about the stability of the post-World War II global order. And that is why I think this has touched a raw nerve here in Europe. So I do think there are questions of international law that Russia has not particularly followed in this particular instance. The law is, by necessity, a bit gray, but nevertheless, I think there is strong consensus that by rushing the referendum and by quickly annexing Crimea, Russia has not followed the requirements of international law in dealing with questions of sovereignty and national self-determination.
Mike, thanks for the call. Let's go to Appleton next and hear from John. John, good morning.
Hi. I was just wondering, what's China's position in all of this? I haven't heard anything about what the Chinese are, whose side they're on.
China has been very quiet. It abstained in the vote in the UN Security Council, which means it didn't support Russia, but it didn't vote with Russia as well. I think China has to be very careful with the notion of self-determination that Russia has now unleashed by recognizing Crimea and the rights of Russian speakers outside its borders. China has various parts of its own internal country, which has high concentrations of ethnic groups. Tibet comes immediately to mind. China does not want to let these groups have any sort of exercise of self-determination. So I think Russia has, in fact, introduced a far more dangerous precedent than was even introduced in the former Yugoslavia and in Kosovo by introducing this notion of self-determination and quick annexation. That's something that China would never go along with, and therefore I think China has been relatively quiet. I don't expect China to play an active role one way or the other. It has substantial trade links with Russia, which undoubtedly will continue. But at least so far, China, like other countries, has been really silent in terms of whether or not to support Russia and its actions in Crimea.
You were quoted, Professor, in an NBCNews.com story as saying that President Putin may be eyeing up eastern Ukraine next. U.S. officials say Russia has 20,000 troops on the Ukrainian border. Give us a sense of how tense that area is today.
It is incredibly tense. And it's the type of situation where any sort of action, any sort of stray bullet could result in a incursion by Russia into eastern Ukraine. And if that were to occur, there is no doubt in my mind that the Ukrainian military would respond. Now, whether the Ukrainian military can actually respond with sufficient force is very much an open question. It appears that President Yanukovych has pretty much gutted the Ukrainian military, and it's unlikely that it could put up a conventional struggle against Russia if it were to indeed intervene in eastern Ukraine. But that being said, Ukraine would fight back both conventionally and unconventionally. And I think there's a real risk to this. I mean, President Putin has issued a very broad statement about his right to intervene in the defense of other Russian speakers. The eastern part of Ukraine has a large portion of Russian speakers, and they have at various times expressed support for Russia. They have traditional trade contacts with Russia. So it is indeed a very, very difficult situation, and one that any sort of unintended or intended act could spark a major crisis.
Well, I mean, given what happened in Crimea with the vote to break away from Ukraine, all the questionable integrity of that election, but what's to stop the pro-Russia crowd in eastern Ukraine from doing the same thing?
Well, so far, the pro-Russian crowd hasn't been that large. And there have been some demonstrations in Kharkiv and in Donetsk, but none that are really kind of overwhelming in numbers. And you also have to recognize that just because one is a Russian speaker doesn't necessarily mean that they're anti-Ukrainian. Indeed, when you talk to Ukrainians, there are plenty of Russian-speaking Ukrainian nationalists. That is not a contradiction in terms. So you haven't necessarily seen a broad response, a major protest as to what was going on in Kiev. And indeed, I think it's fair to say that the interim government, as interim governments go, has done a reasonably good job in keeping the country together and trying to push at least to the presidential elections that are scheduled for late May of this year.
Let's go to the phones again and take a call from Steve in Madison. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I had a question about how Putin is portraying all this to the Russian people. And the reason I ask is because I have a sister-in-law who lives in Germany, but she's Russian, and so they watch the Russian news. And I know, at least in the beginning, Putin was apparently emphasizing the fact that there were neo-Nazi groups in the protests in Kiev. So I'm just curious, how are the Russians hearing this? What is he telling them now?
Well, you're right. There continue to be reports in the Russian media about fascists and neo-Nazis who are in charge in Ukraine. And the Russian media generally, and primarily television media, has tried to portray the events in Ukraine as one of chaos and an illegal coup d'etat that has toppled Mr. Yanukovych, former President Yanukovych. So there's been a heavy dosage of both anti-Ukrainian discussions in the Russian media. And obviously the decision to unite Crimea has been portrayed as one of great reunification and a natural return of a Russian-speaking part of Ukraine to back to the homeland, as it were.
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
I'm just wondering how is then the storming of the military bases? I mean, obviously, he thinks that's a good thing. But.
Yes, again, I mean, that's been a show of strength. Indeed, there have been various images that have come out of the military bases that have been very interesting on both sides. I found the most interesting one was when the Ukrainian troops turned their backs toward the Russian troops when they were asked to give up their arms and then sang the Ukrainian national anthem. That was also a very powerful symbol as the Russian troops marched into these bases. One of the ironic things of this whole past month, and so, really, is that there's always been lots of questions about Ukrainian identity and identity with the nation. But I think the actions in Crimea and Putin's statements has done more for national unity in Ukraine than any Ukrainian politician could have done in the course of decades.
Steve, thanks so much for that call. 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's the number to call to join the program and ask your question about what's going on over in the Ukraine. We've got just a minute or two before we have to go to the news, Professor. Give us kind of maybe we need to provide a little more context for what happened in Crimea. How did that referendum come to pass?
Well, essentially, the Russians organized the referendum within a week, essentially, of having taken over the peninsula. And they simply organized it and held it. And they essentially asked two questions. And when you looked at the questions, it became quite clear that you could not vote no. They were two questions that essentially both would have allowed allowed Crimea to declare its independence and move towards joining the Russian Federation. So it was a very rushed referendum. It's quite clear that although it received a 97% approval, it's quite clear that some parts of the Crimean population, most notably the Crimean Tatars, did not take place and did not participate in the election. They make up 13% of the electorate, and obviously if they had gone to the polls, there would not have been a 97% approval mm-hmm. of the referendum.
We'll continue this discussion on the other side of the news, Professor. 800-642-1234. William Pomerantz is my guest, and your questions always welcome. 800-642-1234. We're talking about the situation in the Ukraine. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the Ukraine. That's what's on our mind this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. My guest is William Pomerantz, Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He's an expert on that part of the world. 800-642-1234, talk at WPR and Facebook, all great ways to get in touch with the program and let us know what you think and what questions you have. Professor, why is Ukraine so much more important than the other 14 sovereign nations that broke apart from the old USSR?
Well, I think it's important because it has such an important relationship to Russia itself. It's seen as the historic and civilizational link to Russia. Russia got its origins in Kiev, as it were. It also is crucial for Russia's kind of great power status. It's a large country, has 45 million people, and in many ways, Russia really can't be perceived as a great power unless it has Ukraine and the resources of Ukraine, both in terms of people and in terms of economic and agricultural resources. So it's a very important part of the geostrategic equation, and it has aroused passions on both sides. And you saw that, as was mentioned in your report, in the Senate last night, and the strong statements of support for Ukraine. I should add that one of the reasons why Ukraine has strong support in the United States is that it does have a very active diaspora community in the United States, and it is able to represent Ukraine's interests as well. So Ukraine is important both from a U.S. perspective in terms of its relationship with Russia, and it also has a political constituency that is able to get its point across.
This is Christy Taylor, producer for The Joy Cardine Show. We are experiencing some technical difficulties with our connection with John Munson, our host. We'll get with you as soon as we can. Thank you.
Okay, I think we solved our problem. I don't know what it was. I apologize for the interruption in the program stream. The gremlins have apparently gotten into the machinery again. Professor, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, great. Now I have to remember where I was. In the news report that we heard on NPR at the half hour, one of the things that was discussed was arming the Ukrainians, providing weapons. What do you think of that as a policy initiative?
Well, I think that is a very provocative step. And obviously what President Obama is trying to do is to control this crisis and not let it get out of hand. And I think what the administration has done is that it has essentially said that if indeed there is an incursion by Russia into eastern Ukraine, it would be met with severe economic sanctions. And I think that's one of the things that President Obama has decided to lead with. that if there is a military action, further military action by Russia, then it would result in essentially trying to isolate Russia, I assume, from the international financial marketplace, as well as targeting specific sectors of the Russian economy and inflicting damage on those. My understanding really is that the administration appears reluctant to start arming the Ukrainians because I think they fear that that would simply lead to an escalation and potentially a preemptive strike by the Russians before those arms arrived. So I think the administration has decided that it would lead with severe sanctions if indeed Russia were to escalate this crisis.
Let's take some more calls. We'll start with George in Monroe.
Good morning. My question is about the removal of Yanukovych. I know he was impeached. I have read, though, that there was a constitution required something like a three-quarters majority, and they didn't have that. And so the question is the legitimacy of the way in which he was removed.
It is true that the impeachment vote did not meet the specific requirements of the Constitution. However, what happened, really, was that Mr. Yanukovych abandoned his post, and he fled first to eastern Ukraine and then to Russia. And at that point, there was a vote taken to appoint an interim government, and that did have three-quarters majority votes in the parliament, in the Rada, and that led to the formation of an interim government. So it's true that technically when the Rada met after Yanukovych met, that it did not necessarily have the necessary votes to fulfill the impeachment, and impeachment under Ukrainian law also required other steps as well. However, what occurred in Ukraine, in reality, was an abandonment of the office by the president, and therefore the legislature had to act to address that issue, the missing executive, and it did so by creating an interim government. I think it also is important to emphasize that Mr. Yanukovych had lost his legitimacy through a variety of actions that occurred, and I'm not really even necessarily referring to the decision not to sign the European Association Agreement, but he passed a series of clearly unconstitutional laws after that event, and he also used security services to fire on unarmed protesters. And through a series of actions, I think Mr. Yanukovych lost his legitimacy, and therefore I think that this interim government is in fact a legitimate government. The important thing is that it moved to elections as fast as possible. Governments with the title interim and provisional don't really have great track records in this part of the world. So I think the sooner that Ukraine has an elected president, the better.
Thanks for the call. I tell you what, we probably should go to break before we take another call. There is a line open if you want to call right now, 800-642-1234. We're talking about the Ukraine, wondering what you think. And with all that's going on over there, what do you think our foreign policy should be? What would you like to see us do or not do relative to the situation in Ukraine? We have an expert with us who's providing his insights, and we'd like to hear what you think as well. 800-642-1234, talk at WPR.org, or find the Joy Cardine program on Facebook and leave your comment or question there. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're having a discussion about the situation in the Ukraine with you and with William Pomeranz, Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies of the Woodrow Wilson Center. Lots of callers want to get in on this topic. Let's take a call from Tom in Wrightstown next. Tom, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'd like to ask your guest if he knows about the negative effects that the protesters may be having on businesses in eastern Ukraine, specifically Kharkiv. My son has a friend. Her family is all Russian-speaking. They're from Kharkiv. And she says that the protesters are hurting the businesses there.
I have no doubt that there has been a decline in business in Kharkiv, in part because of the uncertainty inside Ukraine, and also because, as the caller mentioned, there are traditional business ties between eastern Ukraine and Russia. And there are clear signs that those ties are going to be frayed as a result of what has occurred. And this is really part of the dilemma. The long-term goal and the goal of the EU Association Agreement is to increase trade with Europe and with the hope that they would create a free trade zone between the two countries. At the same time, Russia will not respond well to that, and there's no doubt that it will increase barriers to the crossing of goods and trade between eastern Ukraine and Russia. And on a certain level, it started as an economic debate. So I have no doubt that the economic situation in Kharkiv is more difficult as a result of what has occurred, and that it could face greater difficulty going forward in light of Russia's likely reaction to Ukraine orienting more towards Europe.
Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Victor in Milwaukee. Victor, good morning.
Hello, good morning. Question as far as international foreign policy. With Russia annexing Crimea, Argentina attempted to annex the Falklands. Recently, the Argentine representative argued that the United States and Britain have a double standard regarding this. Do they have a credence to the argument, or is it just baseless?
Well, I'm not an expert in that part of the world, but clearly if there was going to be a question about who maintained the Falklands, and there was obviously in the early 1980s, then there would have to be, at least under international law, some sort of referendum of the people on the Falklands. And the people in the Falklands are primarily British. So obviously Argentina has long held claims for the Falkland Islands, and the British continue to maintain that. Is it a double standard? The whole issue of sovereignty and self-determination is filled with various gray areas that can easily lead to charges of double standards. And obviously, in the 1980s, Britain decided to defend the Falkland Islands against Argentina. So it's really under international law, as I said, a gray area. But the crucial thing is that if you're going to make a claim, if you're going to do something, then you need to bring a consensus that somehow international law favors your cause. And clearly the Russians in this particular instance did not do so.
Thanks, Victor, for that call. The U.S. has hit Russia with two rounds of economic sanctions already. Some experts say that Russia is heading for a recession. So what do you think is going to happen if the Russian people start to suffer, is our thinking that if we put enough pressure on the Russian economy that the Russian people will tell Putin to back off, or might this actually have the opposite effect?
Well, obviously, initial polls suggest that the Russian people have rallied around President Putin, and he is enjoying his greatest popularity that he has in years. At the same time, economic sanctions would undermine that popularity if they really cut into economic growth. And I think this is the big question that Putin faces, and may begin to give some better perspective as to what he has done in Crimea. The economy in Russia is on the edge of recession. It suffers from incredible capital flight. It's estimated that potentially up to $70 billion will leave the country in the first quarter alone, which was more than all of last year. And that is the money that Putin needs to rebuild the economy and get the economy growing again. So there is no doubt that with or without sanctions, Russia faces a economic slowdown. And there's arguments that can be made that Putin, in anticipation of that, has decided to change, as it were, his base of popularity and use kind of the conservative nationalist stance to remain in power, as opposed to the stance that he used during his first two terms, namely that he was a supporter of unprecedented economic growth.
Let's take a call next from Bernie in Elkhorn.
Hi, good morning. I read an article by Robert Parry on consortiumnews.com, and he talks about how the U.S. media, from the so-called liberal to the so-called conservative, are all in lockstep on this Ukraine issue, and that they've all got it wrong, and that basically this what happened in Ukraine was a coup, that the people that were, you know, looking to overthrow the government there were violent people, and that we ended up with an interim government in charge that was what the United States wanted for economic reasons and eventually for geopolitical reasons, eventually to move NATO right up there on Russia's border, as we've been encroaching for years in violation of what was said when the old Soviet Union collapsed. So even though Putin's not a good guy, it sounds like, objectively speaking, he's got a case. And it's scary that we live in a country where a bunch of warmongers like John McCain and, you know, their bipartisan counterparts just ramble on and seem to get the people all stirred up and worried. You know, where is the legitimacy of the United States invading and occupying Iraq, Afghanistan, violating international law, drone strikes killing thousands across borders? I mean, we have no legitimacy whatsoever. Maybe we ought to mind our own business.
Bernie, thanks for the call. Professor?
Well, he's raised a lot of interesting points there. I'll address a couple of them. One, it is interesting that Ukraine seems to be the one issue, and Russia, anti-Russian feeling, is the one issue that seems to unite all of our political parties, both of our political parties. There has been really broad consensus as to that about the response to what has occurred in Ukraine. And that will, as it were, make it easier for President Obama to respond, at least in terms of sanctions and in terms of responding if Russia decides to increase its involvement in eastern Ukraine. So the caller is right in that sense, that anti-Russian feeling and pro-Ukrainian feeling does seem to unite both the Republicans and the Democrats. And it's very rare here in Washington to see them working together. In terms of whether we did this for economic reasons, one has to emphasize that Ukraine right now is an economic basket case, that it's essentially Yanukovych left no money in the Ukraine treasury, and that it will take significant investment from the EU and the United States to transform Ukraine and its economy. This is not an easy path. This will take a long-term commitment to Ukraine. It will require significant changes in Ukraine as well, in terms of transparency, in terms of rule of law, and in terms of how they organize their economy. So although what has occurred really is the U.S. and the EU have now assumed responsibility in many ways for trying to make Ukraine a success. And that will be a very difficult task. Ukraine has resources. It has a highly educated workforce. It has agricultural resources and heavy industry in the east. But it will really take a lot of work for Russia, for Ukraine, to actually become a member of the become a more competitive economy. And I don't think at this stage that there's any possibility that Ukraine actually becomes a member of NATO in the near future.
Let's take a quick call from Bill in Grand Marsh. And, Bill, I'll just give you a fair warning. We're running out of time.
Okay, great. Did you know that a person named Stefan Maduro, which they fly as one of their patriarch on guys that they love from Yatsenyuk, was a guy during World War II who turned in all the Russians and the Jews to the Germans to be killed, just like, you know, George Soros did in Hungary. And also, he's not talking about the international monitors that were watching this election and made sure it was legitimate. And there were no tanks there. You know, the people voted for this. When Yatsenyuk said we want to eliminate all Russian language, what does that mean? That means you're going to eliminate the people. So this guy who got on your show is not all honest. And if the senators who are on the left and right are agreeing with him, that means they're not getting all the information. And Yulia Tymoshenko, Red Begnell, got a thing where she's threatening to destroy Russia on a tape. Go look at that, my friend, Mr. Professor. Then come back on with all the information.
Okay, I want to let the professor have a chance to respond, and then we need to go.
Obviously, there are all sorts of questions about Ukrainian nationalism and whether, in fact, some of the Ukrainian nationalists have really are engaged in extremist activities. And there's no doubt that on the extremes of Ukrainian politics, there are some right-wing groups that cause concern. But if you look at the polls, the recent polls, these right-wing groups have only polled approximately 2 to 3% each of them, and so they are not really perceived as a major political force yet in Ukraine. But it is a great concern that in this part of the world there are extremist politicians and there are people with extremist viewpoints, and in this type of uncertainty, in such an uncertain political environment, there is always a concern that such type of views would come to the fore and play a dominant role in Ukrainian politics. So it's something that is of great concern. There has been examples of this in the past, so it's something that needs to be watched. But so far, at least, the extremist elements of Ukrainian politics have not dominated the current political debate, at least in the post in this interim government.
Well, I think that's where we're going to have to leave it, Professor. Thanks so much for joining me this morning.
My pleasure.
William Pomerantz is Deputy Director of the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies of the Woodrow Wilson Center and Adjunct Professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. Bill Martins produced this hour of programming. Robin Cherry handled on-air production. Christy Taylor was our director. Stick around. We'll have more to come after 8 o'clock as we talk about your income tax questions. Yes, it is tax season. Just about time to send that form in if you haven't already. We'll have the advice with On Your Money after the news. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.